You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
This week on Unforgotten. So today we're here to discuss one of these many. The case of 21-year-old Bradley Nicholas Huey.
Never let anything stop him for what he wanted in life.
April 28th of 2017, and Bradley had been found in the middle of the road with multiple gunshots.
So I came on back in, and they started trying to tell me it was Bradley. I said, no, it's not. I said, Bradley's fine.
It seems like there's a long time between what may have happened and when he left Brooks.
There seems to be very little shared in the news about this, other than when the family has had vigils for Bradley. When you listen to the information from Sherry that she shared, it seems like there would have been quite a bit of information that could have been.
In the beginning, I had hoped that they would, but I lost all hope in them in any kind. And someone had murdered them. Wouldn't you want answers?
Hey, everyone. This is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten.
Where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Be sure to join our Unforgotten Patreon channel today to gain exclusive benefits, including early access to ad-free episodes and bonus content. By subscribing, you'll also be supporting the efforts of ACCA in assisting families and raising awareness for Alabama cold cases.
And now for episode 34, Bradley Huey.
Hey, guys, and welcome back. How you doing, Stormy?
Doing all right. Plugging along. Been a busy week or so. And it's kind of odd because we weren't here last week, right?
I know. It is a little bit different.
It is different, but I think it's helping. And I think, you know, better quality, you know, because we're not rushed. So
true story.
Yeah.
Did y'all end up getting snow?
We did get a little bit. It wasn't a whole lot. It was like, you know, maybe half an inch or an inch for a little while. And then it melted off pretty quickly because it just started raining, you know, type of a thing.
Yeah.
It was mostly at night, a little bit into the morning, but it was kind of pretty to watch. I mean, it was crazy. One day it would look like it was a blizzard, but by the time it was done blizzarding, it like sat around for a few minutes and rained away. So we have been getting really cold nights, though. Still, like, I think tonight, hopefully, we're crossing our fingers, is the last night that it's at or below freezing. So I think, and we're getting some sunshine. So we're hoping to work in the yard this weekend.
It's been chilly in the mornings here, but not.
Yeah.
It warms up over the course of the day. So,
well, that's kind of the way, you know, they say, you look at the forecast and it says like the low tonight is whatever, but it's like 7 o'clock in the morning when it gets to that temperature and then it starts warming up. So, you know, it's not really all night long.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Stormy here. We know that you, our amazing listeners, are highly interested in advocacy and justice and true crime. We love that you care about the cases we share and that you share them with others. We have been very fortunate to have made some truly special friends and advocates in this space. So today, and in some future episodes, we want to share these awesome creators' trailers. Please listen in, and we encourage you to subscribe to their shows.
Relentless, the Fight for Cold Case Justice, is a podcast that will shine a light on unsolved cases and give voices to families fighting tirelessly to see them resolved. We'll talk to advocates and families about their daily battle to keep pushing for answers against seemingly impossible odds. And we'll speak with law enforcement about their complex challenges facing them to clear these cases with growing backlogs and limited resources. My hope is that through these difficult but important discussions, we can work towards finding solutions, both big and small, that may help bring long overdue closure to these families. I refuse to let these families and their loved ones be forgotten. Relentless is their voice, their story, and their fight for justice. Join us at therelentlesspod.com.
As we mentioned we would in the last episode, we are back in Mobile again for today's case. If you were here for our last episode where we covered Tash Wilson's case, and if you haven't listened yet, we hope you will, you will recall that we highlighted that there is sadly a large number of missing persons and homicide cases that are growing cold in Mobile County. It feels like the number of these cases is growing as well, though I haven't actually found a statistic to support that yet, but it sure feels that way.
I don't know that there's reporting for that.
I don't think there is. I think that's why it's been difficult to find anything. I mean, even the stats that I did look at, as far as their like homicide rates, which the reporting is really inconsistent, I guess.
Yeah.
And so it's really difficult to even pinpoint what the rates are for, violent and homicide crimes.
They changed kind of the classifications in the way the reporting is characterized, I think.
They did.
In 2017 or 2019. I can't remember
exactly. I think it was 2019, if I remember right.
You used to be able to go to the Alabama Crime website and look at the reporting numbers, and it would tell you what percent were cleared. Now it doesn't do that. Everything's kind of grouped into one kind of broad category. So you can't tell how the arrests are attributed.
Right. I guess.
So it makes it really hard to get an actual clearance rate.
Yeah. And, I don't know if it was the same year or if it was, I want to say it might have been like 2020, 21, something like that. But maybe it was the same year that this changed. There was some error in the reporting and it actually doubled the amount of homicide and violent cases. And I think it was just homicides. Well, maybe it was everything across the board, but the number for I was looking at was homicides.
I think they started using like a different system or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was what it was. So they did have to like publish a correction in that. But still, when I did for Mobile as a city, there are many different reports and articles, as I was saying, and some state that it's actually the second most violent city in the U.S.,
Wow.
And the highest is actually Birmingham. So yay for Alabama. And this is, of course, per capita. So it's like a percentage, right?
Lowest on transparency and highest on violence.
Yeah, that's kind of scary.
Yeah.
All of them, all the different reports, so do paint this kind of unfortunately high percentage regardless of the differences. And I think it's safe to say that Mobile is at least among the top five cities in the U.S.
Wow.
Which is just scary. Yeah. Like I said, I know we've talked about this subject quite a bit, so I'm not going to go on much more about it. And I'm not going to hop on a soapbox anymore at the top of this episode. I think sellers will hold back a little bit, at least for now.
I think we've talked about it before.
Yeah. So I will CYA and say I can't promise neither of us will get the good old box out, before the end of the episode, but we'll try to keep it tucked away for a while.
No promises.
Yeah. So mostly the reason I'm mentioning this is that Alabama does have a few counties with a high number of missing person and homicide cases. And this is why we felt the need to cover at least one more case in Mobile County before moving forward to our next county.
So today we're here to discuss one of these many, the case of 21-year-old Bradley Nicholas Huey. To help us tell his story, we were fortunate enough to be able to talk to Bradley's mother, Sherry Taylor. She helped us learn a bit about who Bradley was as a person, We always feel grateful when we have a family member that can share a little bit about their loved one's life, so that those listening are reminded that these cases involve victims who are not just statistics, but human beings with loved ones who miss them.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
All right, Ms. Sherry, you want to introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and how you're related to Bradley.
Okay, I am Sherry Taylor. My son, Bradley, he was my last child.
How many children do you have?
Well, I have four, two girls and two boys. My oldest is, you know, a girl, girl, boy.
And Bradley's a baby?
Yes, he was.
Hey, that's mm-hmm. That's a good ratio.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. Bradley was a joy to us. You know, he was very intelligent, and he was a playful, really playful type person. You know, he was kind of like the light of the family. You know, he was never afraid to stand up and speak his mind, never had a shy bone. I'm kind of shy, but he didn't, you know, he was very outgoing. I will say that about him.
We learned from Sherry and from other interviews we listened to that Bradley loved to play basketball and also had a great time doing rap battles with his cousin Brandon. He also had dreams of being a boxer, but it seems the aspiration that stuck with him to adulthood was to become a firefighter one day.
I always wanted to become a firefighter. That was his goal in life.
Wow.
To become a firefighter. And I believe he would have, you know, because he, you know, didn't never let anything stop him for what he wanted in life. He used to always like to debate with people, ask them about some, you know, things like words to see if they knew what they were, okay. What they meant. You know, he was very smart. And he would always, you know, see if they meant, and they would just get frustrated with it. He was playful in that way, you know.
Yeah.
And very smart. He read a lot, you know, he loved reading. So, you know, he always knew what would, you know, he used to try to school me on a lot of things.
Hey, kids know everything, don't you know?
Yeah, he thought he did. He really did. Uh-huh. And he was friendly with anybody, you know.
In high school, Bradley met his then-girlfriend, Raven, and they had a son together when he was about 17 years old that they named Cayenne, or Cash, as they called him. You know, his pictures, he had the prettiest smile with his dimples.
Uh-huh. He was
just had the prettiest smile.
Yes, he was very attractive. And, you know, he had a problem with a lot of older women, you know, trying to talk, you know, trying to date him and all. He always did, you know.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that how it goes?
Uh-huh. Yeah, but he did. He met this girl, Raven, and they got into a relationship. And he ended up having a baby with her. His son's name is Cayenne, which we call him Cash.
I like that.
Yes.
How old is he now, then?
His son is now, he turned 10 February the 9th. So he was about 3 years old, I think, when that happened. Three or four. Because, well, it's been 6 years, 2017. So, yeah, he was about 4 years old when his dad was taken from him. And right now his son is so distraught about it, you know. He cries at times about it. I feel so bad for him. He's the only child with his mom. He's the only child. Well, and he was Bradley's only child. You know, he misses his dad. He wish he was here. And he cries all the time, you know. And it's nothing I can do to make it better for him. You know, we just try to show him that we do love him, you know.
Yeah.
And all the, you know, anything I can do.
You just try to kind of fill that gap.
Yeah, we try.
Yeah.
But it's hard to feel the depth of a dad.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. And I hate that. I hate that for him.
Well, and he's at that age where he really, at 10 years old, that's a ripe age.
Yes, he really need him at this time, at this stage in life. You know, it's very hard for him now without his dad.
Bradley later entered into a relationship with a young woman named Nora Holmes, who would eventually become his wife in the year before his death. Well, you know, we actually went onto the probate court records to try to find the marriage certificate for Bradley and Nora so that we would have kind of a time frame for when they actually got married. Sherry said that she remembered getting a picture of the marriage certificate, but she couldn't remember the exact date. But I couldn't find any records whatsoever in the probate court where Bradley and Nora actually got married. And so at the time, it's not like that now, or like this now, but you used to have to actually go in and file for a marriage application, or you filled out an application for your marriage certificate, and then you would get it. And then you either went over to the probate judge's office, or when you had your ceremony, and whoever performed the ceremony, whether it was the judge or an ordained minister, would sign off on it. And then you sent that in.
Yeah.
And you had to get it so many days before the actual ceremony and have it sent in so many days after it. And then it was recorded. And that's what actually made it official.
That's what we have here too. Yeah.
Now it's not like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They don't, you don't actually, Alabama passed a law where you don't actually do that anymore. Nobody has to sign off on it. You just fill it out yourself. It's
really
weird. It's different.
I mean, do you still send it in and there's an official one on file somewhere?
Yeah, I think so. Like you just go down there, fill it out, and I think that's it. But you don't have to have like somebody, an ordained person, sign off on it.
Or a judge. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So
anybody could do it. They wouldn't even have to have a ceremony. They could just grab one and say they're married.
Yep, pretty much.
that's weird.
That's my understanding anyway. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
So there should be a recorded copy of the marriage certificate.
Yeah.
Because at this point in time, you know, this was still a thing where either a judge or an ordained minister would have had to have signed off on it. And there's not one. And so I don't know if it's...
I wonder if they had it, but they didn't go down and file it.
That was what I was wondering. Did they maybe not just turn it in?
Yeah.
So what does that mean for a marriage?
Yeah,
If you actually don't send it in and have it recorded, what happens?
I mean, at the time, I would think that would mean it's not official. I mean, legally, I would guess an attorney could fight that, but
yeah.
If it was today, they probably wouldn't, they probably would throw out the argument since it's changed, but
yeah,
it is interesting. I mean, that could,
I think you would have to
have a lot of legal repercussions if there was any kind of a financial dispute or anything.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. So Bradley had started working when he was about 16 and he worked at Winn-Dixie. For those of you who aren't from Alabama, like me, they're in the southern states down there. That's a supermarket chain.
Where did he go to school at?
At LaFleur High School. He graduated from LaFleur. And after that, he worked at, where did he work? Well, he was working since he was 16. He was working at Winn-Dixie. And he worked at the one on Government Street. And he worked at Winn-Dixie on Greelock Road. And then when he got older, he went to work at the waterworks in Pritchett, Alabama, the water company, you know, where he worked the overnight shift at the plant, I guess that's what it's called out there. But he had plans to do more than that, you know. You know, plans always get taken away from people. You know, life don't go as planned. He wanted to become a firefighter. That's what he, that was his plan.
So at that point, he still was wanting
to. Yeah, he still wanted to be that.
Oh, I'm sorry he didn't get to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, Bradley and his wife started struggling a bit. And though Sherry isn't sure why, possibly financial reasons, Nora joined the Job Corps, which is crazy because I don't know anybody who joined the Job Corps, but most people are really young. I mean, not that they weren't young, but like usually they're single, like teen just out of high school or maybe even haven't graduated high school because they dropped out. So shortly after, Bradley went to stay with his mom during that time.
Right before that happened to him, she went to Job Corps and she was there when that happened to him.
What is that?
But she was at, it's Job Corps, it's something like a, it's like a, like really going to the army, but it's on a lower level, you know, like it's a certain age, I think 17 to 25 mm-hmm. or something like that. You can go there and learn a trade or something.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Anyway, that's where she was when it happened, about a week after she went, you know.
On April 27th, 2017, Sherry was getting herself ready to head to her mother's to stay for the night due to electrical issues at home and called Bradley to let him know he should come grab some clothes and things that he might need for the next day before it got too dark. He arrived between 5 and 6 p.m. and they were chatting for a little bit. Here's Sherry to tell us about the last conversation she had with him and what was to come not long after. Day of Bradley's murder. Do you remember what day that was?
Yes, I do. It was, well, okay, I went to spend the night with my mom because my house I was living in, I had electrical problems all the time. Mm-hmm. So the lights went out that night, that day, and I couldn't get them back on. So I called the landlord and, you know, he couldn't make it that day. But anyway, Bradley had moved in with me by that time. So I called him on his phone. I said, Bradley, I'm going to spend the night with mom. So if you need some clothes for tomorrow, come and get something before it get dark and we can't see in here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came and me and him was talking. He had decided he was going to do truck driving, you know. And I said, well, good. Because we was talking about my daughter, her boyfriend had just became a truck driver. So Bradley had really by then decided he would do that. And so after that, that was the last time I saw him. We was talking, you know, and so I went to my mom's house to spend the night, you know. I remember that day so plainly, everything that happened. It's crazy. So I went and I went to my mom's house. We was over there, me and my daughter and her, my grandson. By then, I went into my mom wanted some banana nut bread. I went and got her some and some coffee from Starbucks. And we all sat there and watched TV and went to sleep. I called my daughter because my daughter was over there cooking and she was going to bring us something. And she never did come and bring us anything. So I called and she told me she was, but well, they got done cooking late. So anyway, I went to sleep by then. And the next thing I know, I was going to work that morning. About 7, you know, I have to be to work at 7. So about 4 o'clock in the morning, I heard somebody knocking at the door. My heart dropped immediately because nobody, you know, that time of morning, a knock on the door,
yeah.
You think the worst anyway. And when I saw it was the police, it just did something to me. So I answered the door and they start asking me, when was the last time I seen Bradley? And, you know, I told them, and I, you know, and then they was trying to talk to me. I wouldn't even talk to them. I went in the bathroom and by then my daughter came out the bedroom and all. And I just wouldn't talk to them. I went in there because I didn't want to hear anything.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. She started telling me, oh, mom, you need to come in here and talk to them and see what's going on. And so I came on back in. And they start trying to tell me it was Bradley. I said, no, it's not. I said, Bradley's fine. Nothing is wrong with him, you know. And so they finally told me. And I just, you know, oh, that was the worst day of my life. Still is. It's etched in my mind forever. And they start telling me, asking me about his tattoos, you know. And asking me about, the, you know, the Bradley Jr. tattoo. And I just couldn't believe it, you know.
What did they tell you had happened?
Well, I don't even remember that part. It was just all they told me that was he was gone.
And, you know, and the emotions are high at that point too, shock mm-hmm. and all of these things. And you probably, you know, you say things, and then I know there have been times that I've left conversations thinking, I don't even know what was said, you know, because it's just your mind is reeling and you're trying to like piece all this together, like how it could have happened. You just saw them and, you know, it's a lot.
It had actually barely become a new day, April 28th of 2017. And Bradley had been found on East Octavia Drive and Vermilion Drive, which is in the Navco residential area of Southeast Mobile, in the middle of the road with multiple gunshots. No ID, no car, no phone, and no shoes, oddly. To paint a clearer picture of where this neighborhood was, it's a quieter neighborhood called Vermilion Place off Navco Road. You can enter the neighborhood at Vermilion Drive or at East Octavia Drive, and the two intersect at the far end of that neighborhood. It's kind of a, like almost like an enclosed neighborhood, although there's, you know, no fences or gates or anything like that. From reports in the media, there are some variations in the timing of when Bradley was spotted and other accounts from when officers arrived on the scene. Mobile police records say they located him at 12:05 a.m., which is probably accurate because they have to record that. But there were accountings that he was seen by passerbys at 12:15 a.m. Neighbors reported hearing gunshots before 2 a.m. Some came out of their houses to see the scene in the early hours of the morning. So a lot of the accounts were not very specific on time and really could mean the same thing. They just didn't have all the timing or understood the details, you know, they were hearing or seeing. So it could mean that there was a lot more going on than what occurred with Bradley even that night.
And, you know, probably around that time too, if people are asleep, mm-hmm. they may not be looking at a clock.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. If something wakes them up, they may just be guessing.
That's very true. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just assuming, like, just based on maybe the last time they had looked at a clock.
That's, yeah. And, you know, when you wake up, you're just kind of, you're, brain isn't functioning. Some people automatically look at the clock and some people just kind of get up and wander out of bed because they heard something, yep. you know.
Yeah. So. We also know that this was not the only shooting that occurred that night. Only 3 miles away, two other shootings occurred. They were not life-threatening injuries and we don't have any information about them, except that one likely wasn't related due to it possibly being a domestic dispute. One of the shootings was on Dominick Street and one on Duval Street. So we were able to find a little bit of information on those two shootings.
Mm-hmm.
So one happened at roughly 10:20 p.m. Officers responded to the 1500 block of Dominick Street in reference to one shot, and they found a victim suffering from an apparent gunshot. This is kind of weird, actually, because it says one shot and the victim was suffering from apparent gunshot wounds to the chest and arm. Yeah. So I guess it could be one shot, the bullet traveled through the chest and arm.
It could
making
be
multiple wounds.
Because I think this is the same one that I looked at in a like another newspaper article, or I don't sure where this one came from, but
that one
just said he was shot in the arm. So
yeah, and it was non life threatening,
right? Yeah. So you would think if it was in the chest, it would have been a little more life threatening.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. The victim stated that he was outside of his residence when a black pickup truck drove by and opened fire on him. Mm. Then the second one happened around 11:53 in the 1300 block of Duval Street. And officers responded to, again, one shot. They located a victim suffering from gunshot wounds to both legs and stated that the incident occurred in the campground area. And that an unknown suspect drove up to him and began shooting at him. He was also transported to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries.
Okay.
So,
and so I'm looking at the map, and Duval is on one side of the highway. Where this was located was on the east side of the highway, I had to think. On the east side of the highway, and the other one was on the west side of the highway, but they were not very far apart at all. They were about a quarter of a mile apart.
and by Google Maps, they were about a 9 to 10 minute drive from where Bradley was left in the street. It does make you wonder if one of the shootings had anything to do with Bradley's death. So what we know is that Bradley was hanging out at his sister Brooke's place that evening after leaving his mother's home on April 27th. Brooke's place was only a couple miles or so from Sherry's, and Brandon lived somewhat nearby as well, and Brandon is Bradley's cousin. Around 11 p.m. that night, Bradley had decided to go find some weed to purchase. Brooke was going to cook some late dinner while he was gone, but he never returned. And Sherry shared a little bit more about all of this with us.
Well, there's one thing. My daughter was looking on Facebook, and she saw a post on Facebook where somebody said, check on your people. There's a young boy dead, you know, and wherever it was. And that was at 11-something on April the 28th, you know. And so at that time, she didn't think nothing of it because my son was spending the night with her. And he went off, you know, well, you know, I told you he smoked weed. He was trying to get some weed. That's where he was going. And come back and eat dinner with them. And so when he came, she waited on him and left the door open for him. And she said he had never made it back. And she got up later on and locked the door.
We don't know exactly where Bradley was going to obtain the weed. As mentioned, it was less than a 5-minute drive from Brooks to the area where Bradley was lying. It was also less than 10 minutes from where the other shootings had taken place. To add to the questions, though there were reports of gunshots, Sherry has mentioned that some people in the area said they didn't hear any gunshots. So this seems like there's a long time between what may have happened and when he left Brooks. I mean, is it possible he went elsewhere and whomever he interacted with shot him there and then drove him with his car and left him where he was found?
I mean, that's possible.
Seems pretty plausible, yeah.
It actually happened somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just kind of dumped him there.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you can hear gunshots from pretty far away.
Yeah.
So even if they were within a mile or even within the 3 miles, you know, where the other two shootings were, it's very possible that people could have heard that, especially if there wasn't a lot else going on. The neighborhoods weren't that far apart, you know. So.
And you would think, too, that there would be traffic cameras.
You would think somewhere there would be. I mean, maybe not on the back streets.
You know, gas stations. That area is, if you look at the map, it's like not far from the interstate.
Right. It's actually like where he was really kind of sits like right next to the interstate, except there's, you know, a lot of land between it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, if you look at it, it almost looks like it's sitting on the interstate. There's just a lot of houses and trees between it.
Yeah. So you would think there would be some kind of traffic cams or something there. And I mean, you are right. The sound travels really far.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a long time. So,
yeah. Yeah. It just seems, I mean, for that short of a distance, 11 p.m., 12 p.m.
And how far was Brooks' house?
I mean,
was it less than 5 minutes?
Yeah. Less than 5 minutes. I mean, it was like maybe a mile from where he was left. So it's not like he drove straight. I mean, he could have, I guess, you know, theoretically, he could have gone to that neighborhood and it was somebody in the neighborhood he was visiting. And then it happened.
Like,
and
it could have been somebody's house in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. And it might not even have been them that, you know, shot him. He could have been there hanging out, talking to them about what they were doing. He could have left the house and then, you know. So
met somebody.
There are scenarios, or you know, somebody could have known that's where he was going, and you know, who knows. So this kind of leads us to his car. Several hours later in the morning, his car was located about 10 miles north of Bradley. It had burned in an area called Alabama Village, and Sherry tells us a little about this.
What kind of car was it?
It was a BMW, black BMW. I don't know exactly what kind, but it was really nice, you know.
And
they burned it. That's why I feel like it was somebody, my son won't let nobody get close to him like that. That's why I feel like it had to be somebody he knew, you know.
You have to wonder, different things happened here in Mobile. There, mm-hmm. And I cannot remember her name now, but there was a young lady that was driving in Mobile, and I think it was early one morning. She was on her way to work.
Yes, I remember.
And, you know, somebody came up to her car and shot her.
Yeah, I remember that. You're right about that.
Have they said, do they think that that's kind of what happened? Somebody maybe came up to Bradley at that intersection, or do they think somebody was with him?
They never told us that, but I think somebody had to be in the car with them. I don't know. But nobody went with them when I don't even know if somebody was in the car when he went by my daughter's house, because he didn't stay there long then. When he went by there, you know, that time, he had been there, you know, over my nephew's house. So.
Right.
I just don't know. I wish you be thinking about things and wishing you knew the look more closely.
Right.
At the time, and then it'd be too late, you know.
So, was there anything else missing as far as you know?
Oh, he didn't have shoes on. He was in the street with a tank top or something on, and his shoes was gone. I don't even know what kind he had on. And, you know, they just threw him out there like a dog in the street.
Did he still have his wallet?
No. And after that happened, you know, about a week later, I think somebody brought his driver's license and put it on my porch.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, God, why didn't I have cameras back then? Oh, I wish, you know.
I wonder if they checked to see, you know, when it all started being kind of a big deal, the doorbells, the Ring doorbells and security camera. Oh. I wonder if they kind of went around the area to see if there was anybody that did have cameras.
I doubt it. I didn't see them talking to anybody. Mm-mm.
I was just thinking that if this wasn't just a robbery of sorts, I was thinking it could be a message if they took his shoes. I don't exactly sure what the message would be, but I know from experience with people I've known in the distant past who have had drug problems that people will take anything to sell if they're in that kind mm-hmm. of shape. So it's very possible that they did take, you know, those things as a robbery. It does seem a little odd that they would leave his car to be burned. But, you know.
Well, it's also a way to get rid of evidence.
Yeah. Is true. If they stole everything and then burned his car because there was blood in it or whatever. Yeah.
And to me, though, it's almost like a spiteful type thing.
Yeah.
Like, we took your life and now we're going to take your shoes, too. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't enough
yeah.
to steal his life. We're going to take everything else, too. We're going to steal everything else, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and from the sounds of it, you know, what he was going to buy some weed, but it sounded like from what Sherry was saying that it probably was somebody he would have gone to somebody he kind of knew that was in that mm-hmm. circle of people that he knew. It wouldn't be like he was just going down the street to somebody he didn't know, you know, trying to buy from somebody and they were shady. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. It's hard to know.
Yeah.
So Sherry tells us that not only did Bradley's car get taken and burned, the phone and wallet disappear, but he also had a gun that was taken and never recovered.
And you know he had a gun of his own, too, at the time, and they got it.
Was it in his vehicle or on him, or it wasn't like they took it?
No, somebody stole that. Yes.
Oh, my God.
When they did that, they got it with
them. Mm-hmm. Was it ever recovered?
No, never recovered. And we tried to get, you know, because he bought it from this guy, you know, mm-hmm. this guy. We went all the way back to the person who it belonged to, who sold it, you know.
There seems to be very little shared in the news about this, other than when the family has had vigils for Bradley. But when you listen to the information from Sherry that she shared, it seems like there would have been quite a bit of information that could have been followed up on. It also seems like there may not have been much done after the initial investigation. After all of this happened, you know, how long or how active were the police in trying to search for answers.
In the beginning, it seemed like they was active in it.
Mm-hmm.
But seemed like after that, and then, you know, we had Detective Booth on the case. Seemed like he was doing a good job. And then later, and we started getting out, putting flyers out and all that. And then later, we talked to the chief later, and he said that detective told him that he tried to get us out there to do this, and we didn't show up. And that was the biggest lie. He came out there with us, and we put flyers out everywhere. We put them out everywhere. We went exactly to the spot, and then told us about this guy. And he told us where he lived and asked us, like, he wanted us to do something to, you know, yeah, do street justice in my book. That's the way I took it.
Right.
You know, it's crazy.
Huh.
I just don't know. And that guy, with my daughter, she went around everywhere over there talking to everybody. And she talked to the guy. And in the beginning, he told her something, you know, that just don't sit right.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it was more than one or two people.
It would seem very much like there, it couldn't have been, you know, a one person thing.
Somebody had to help him get him in the car and, you know, get him out the car. And another thing, they had to,
yeah,
go take the car over to Alabama Village and get it burned. And then somebody had to pick them up and take them off. You know, it was more than one person.
We had talked to Sherry quite a while back about contacting the Cold Case Foundation to see if they could assist her in any way. And she actually did reach out to the foundation to see if they would be willing to look at Bradley's case. They actually asked for some additional information, so she reached out to Mobile Police Department to get some information to send them. Of course, they wouldn't send Sherry very much information. They actually sent her like a 3-page summary that provided little to no information at all. I was really frustrated whenever you sent, because you had actually sent the Bradley's case to the Cold Case Foundation, and they were interested in it. And when you asked for the records to send them, Mobile Police Department gave you 3 pages of documents, yeah, that were really unhelpful.
Yeah, they don't want to help. In the beginning, I had hoped that they would, but I lost all hope in them and any kind of, you know, confidence in that, the police department. And we went so many times up there, they wouldn't even see us most of the times. You know, when we went up there to talk to them and see where they at, they never once called me and updated me on the case, nothing. You know, it's like, okay, your son is dead. That's the end of that, you know.
Yep.
We gotta.
And that is not the way to handle it.
It's not.
Because the person responsible is still, and you know, and I think this is what always makes me so mad. I'm like, you know what? It's not okay for you to blow people off, the victims or their families, because mm-hmm. they're people. And, you know, even if the person had been making terrible life decisions, their family wasn't making those decisions.
Yeah.
So
it wasn't,
you and their children, you know, they are still very loved, very missed. And so even if you've in your mind made it up that, okay, well, you know what? They had a drug history or they had this or that, you know, it's whatever. Nobody really is going to miss them.
Mm-hmm.
What you need to be thinking about is that there is somebody responsible for that.
That's
and
right.
That they are still walking around out there free mm-hmm. with nothing but air and opportunity to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've been on a kick about this because it seems to be coming up in like almost not every case, but yeah, almost every case that mm-hmm. we.
And I feel like Mobile Police Department pick and choose what cases they want to solve.
Yep.
Yes.
I absolutely agree with you.
Like this happened around the time this guy got murdered out of this store over there on Dolphin Street. I forgot. Grills, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
This older white veteran man, the chief at the time, was up there. He was saying, we're going to make sure we solve this high profile murder. And I feel like what makes that so such of a high profile over my son, you know, why can't people be the same? That's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why did he get more, you know, his case required more, you know, attention than my son's, you know? He has somebody who loved him just like the other man, you know?
Yep.
That's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I just say it's the way the world is.
And that basically just said.
That irritated me so bad. Are we going to get on a soapbox? Can we slide the soapbox out?
Oh my gosh. Basically, all it said was, yeah, that basically said because.
There you go.
The case was pending / unsolved, which obviously,
you know. Like that.
And it had basically a list of things that they had. And this is a legitimate organization, right?
Right.
It's comprised of like retired detectives. Like, I think there's even actually people that used to work for Mobile Police Department, maybe, that are on
it.
There's like a large number of investigators that work with the Cold Case Foundation.
Yeah. Professional and, people in this line of work.
You know, I can understand this whole hesitancy to maybe release the information to a family member. I get it. Whatever. Mm-hmm. But when they're telling you like, hey, they've asked for this, why don't you contact the Cold Case Foundation and say, hey, we've had a family member reach out and say, you guys have requested information. Who can we send it to?
Or even ask questions. Rather than blanketly just kind of putting them
like,
on.
If you're interested in doing this, I'll take the, we're busy. I'm mm-hmm. swamped. I'll take the help.
Yeah.
Because what does it hurt?
Yeah.
I mean, nothing. Nothing.
Right.
One person.
And, you know, they can put it in conditionally, you know, please don't release this to the family or the public. But if you are able to help, you know.
And I'm pretty sure that they don't do that anyway.
Yeah, they don't.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And there are hundreds of organizations. Maybe not hundreds, but, mm-hmm. you know, there are numerous organizations that do these kind of reviews.
Yep.
And they are out there for agencies to utilize. They just have to do it.
Yeah.
And what sense does it make to continue saying, nope, I'm just going to hoard all these files over here and I'll work on them as one person as I get the chance, as opposed to reaching out to this resource that has more people with potentially more time to help me make the most of my time.
Right.
Because I know that I also have active cases, like new cases that are coming in that are going to obviously be prioritized over these older cases, which in turn keeps pushing these older cases down further.
Yeah.
It doesn't make them less important.
No, it doesn't.
Because what actually it means is that I have a murderer sitting over here with a murderer still walking around out on the street.
Yeah. That's what gets me. All of it bothers me, but that's actually like neglecting the public safety.
Right?
It just...
And so you're just leaving somebody responsible for this out there walking around with nothing but air and opportunity mm-hmm. in front of them to just repeat it again.
Yep.
And so what happens when it's your family member?
Yeah.
Because you never know. I mean, things happen.
They do. And, you know, you don't wish that on anybody at all, but...
No. And that's the whole point of, like, you make it safer. Like, just use the resources that are available and help make it better.
Yeah. And we've talked about this before. You know, I can't help but think that a lot of it is, well, for lack of a better word, pride. You know, they don't want to admit that they can't handle the volume or they can't handle the case at the moment because, you know, they're too busy or that they have neglected it and didn't, you know, bother to get into it. And even though they could have, you know, it just, yeah.
I'm
There's
hoping
so many reasons that it could, that could be legitimate, but there are a lot of reasons that I think aren't as legitimate.
I am really hoping with the recent movement in the Brittany Robinson case.
Yeah.
That it means some of these cold cases in Mobile County are going to start also seeing some movement.
Yeah. Families maybe are going to see that and really start pushing for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope so anyway.
I do too. One thing that does stand out in the summary is that it said when the police officers arrived, Bradley was covered in ants. I thought that was kind of odd. I kind of didn't pick it up the first time I read it, but then I was kind of going back through as we were preparing for this, and I saw it again, and I was like, that's pretty fast. If, you know, yeah. I mean, you got to think, he left his sisters at 11. He was found at 12:05. Somewhere in between there, he was shot and possibly driven to that location and left there. That's not very long for him to be covered in insects. So I am just a little, weird. I have a lot of questions about that.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk to, an entomologist about that?
We always try to ask the family if they could say anything to the person responsible, what would they say?
Think about if it was your family and someone had murdered them, wouldn't you want answers? Or it's going to eat you alive inside if you have a conscience. You know, some people don't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you reap what you sow.
Our thanks to Sherry for sharing Bradley and his case with us so that we can try to get as much information shared with all of you. Our hearts are so with Bradley's family, especially his son, who was robbed of a lifetime of father-son memories. Our call to action is twofold. First, and I'll slide the soapbox out just a little bit. Maybe just keep it beside me. We ask emphatically for Mobile Police to not only review and put forth renewed efforts in Bradley's case, but to reach out to his family to provide updates so that they can have some reassurances that you believe his case is important to you to solve.
And secondly, for those out there who may know anything, no matter how big or small, please come forward. You can contact Mobile Police Department at 251-208-7211 or submit an anonymous tip on their website at mobilepd.org. You may also contact us on our website regarding this or any Alabama cases at alcoldcase.com. As usual, we will include all contact information in the episode details.
Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Spotify for Podcasters, available on your favorite podcast platform. Intro music for the show was created by Principles of Uncertainty, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Content and production is by Sellers and Stormy. Artwork by Sellers. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and any source referenced in our podcast can be found in each episode's description. We hope you will join us on all the major social media sites and continue to raise awareness of our Alabama cold cases. Until next time, thank you for listening, and remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.